The Rebel Capitalist Show, episode 81.
Welcome to the podcast that helps you build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. This is the Rebel Capitalist Show.
I know a lot of people are tuning into this video to hear your thoughts on what to invest in, how to set up a portfolio, what's going up, what's going down. You brought up oil before, and I know that's something that's really on everyone's mind. So let's start there. And I've actually got your most recent Insider Weekly report. So for those of my viewers who don't know, Chris is a hedge fund manager, but he also does fantastic research. And he's got a product called Insider. We're an affiliate. So if you want to go to georgegammon.com and check it out, it's at the resources or the recommended resources page. But I'm reading from your last Insider Weekly, which is a less dense version of Insider or Capital's Exploits Insider. And so the last one that I have in front of me, you talked about something specific. So I want to dive into that and get your feedback on what you wrote. But starting with oil, I did, and I see that you talked about Dutch Shell, which I really want to go into. But I did a video on oil the other day where I went back like Jim Rogers, and I looked at some, unfortunately, I just went back to the 1950s with the chart that I had. But I saw that when we actually had oil go down in real terms from 1950 to 1970. And then, of course, in the 1970s and 1980, it went up dramatically. But I noticed one thing that would kind of trigger the next move up from 1970 all the way to, call it, 2012, was when you would have a crash in the stock market or asset prices. So I did some reading on that. I saw a lot of experts say that's because if you have like a 60% down move in stocks or strictly financial assets, that people say, okay, I'm done with those. I want something real. I want something tangible, like commodities or like oil. So the first thing I wanted to ask you is, if we assume that we're not going to all new highs in the stock market, and we're going to revisit the lows because of the virus or what have you, and that asset prices are going to go down in nominal terms over the next year or 2 years, do you think that could be a catalyst to also drive commodity prices higher, more specifically oil?
I'm going to take oil and put it a little bit to the side.
Okay.
Only insofar as oil's been through, it's what's happening right now is really unique, right? Where the Saudis and the Russians are having a fist fight and trying to, you know, gain market share in the face of a world that is not driving. So that's a truly unique setup, which we've never really seen before, to the extent where, as you know, we went negative on oil a month or so back. And you'd ask yourself, how is it possible to be negative on anything that's actually got a real, you know, there's been that saying, you know, a lot of gold bugs, for example, saying, oh, you know, gold can never go to zero. And you could say the same of, you know, beef cattle. Well, they can, right?
The future because,
even in the physical market, think about what we were talking about before with respect to farmers who their supply chain is now considered non-essential, right? So they were supplying maybe a hotel, the hotel is shut down, and so they have to slaughter their beef cattle. There's a cost to that because nobody wants it. They don't have any demand for it. There is a cost to actually, you know, getting rid of the cattle. If they weren't going to shoot them and burn them or bury them, they would have to pay somebody to take them away. And that's essentially what's happened in the oil market.
Or housing in Detroit is another good example, where at a time they're literally giving houses away. Well, how is that? Because you got to still pay the property taxes and the upkeep
and yeah. So, you know, so there is a commodities, yes, will have that sort of tangible value, but they can go negative, clearly. in certain environments. So to your point on the stock market and how things go with booms and busts there, you know, there's a dynamic in terms of risk. Now, financial assets in a risk on environment, financial assets always wonderful to own, typically because you've got better operating margins. You want to be owning financial assets in a boom, even in a crack up boom, which is fueled by silly money from Fed or whoever. So, and that's really one reason that I'm not prepared to be short the market. And look, the market's fantastically overvalued. I mean, we're what, a few percent off the highs, and the world's been shut down. It's absurd. But there's those other components where it could potentially be a relative basis, because everyone's going, well, hang on a second, the Fed are probably just going to do everything that they can do. They're going to bring the kitchen sink to this, and maybe they will, and probably they will. But potentially there's some period of time where the market corrects and then they come at it. Or I don't feel like I have any edge there, so I prefer not to play. I know that it's overvalued, but there's many things that can impact that. So, but back to the point on oil, there's what's taking place now is extraordinary supply destruction, to an extent that I've never seen in my career. And I've gone back and I've looked at previous, this has never happened before. I mean, Mexico is basically screwed. Nigeria is screwed. This entire countries and economies are shutting down production because they can't operate at these levels. And it's not possible to just turn those taps back on. The oil markets don't work like that. Once you shutter wells, it's not that easy. Shale's a little bit easier than other market than other, you know, energy markets. But the point is, there's massive supply destruction taking place. We have a glut that's largely priced, and so we are setting up for one of the most phenomenal oil booms, I think, that we're ever going to see in our lifetime. Now, that could well take quite some time. But, you know, you talk about Jim Rogers, you know, you buy when they are giving it away. Mm-hmm. That's when you buy things. And they're giving it away. So you take a company like Royal Dutch Shell. Yeah. I mean, think about it like this. So all of that we've discussed with respect to, like, UBI, the debts, all of these factors. Tell me, what would you rather have in 10 years' time? You could have been paid to take a barrel of oil. Or let's just make it easy. You could have bought it for a dollar.
Mm.
You know, would you rather have a barrel of oil in 10 years' time? Or would you rather have a dollar? It's that simple. I know where I'm going to, you know, lay my chips. And that's without even considering the geopolitical setup that is very, very quickly getting freaking off the rails, whereby trade agreements are being shattered, whereby supply chains are coming under pressure. You know, we just saw it with the Chinese and the Australians, where the Australians asked the Chinese for an independent inquiry into this virus and how it came about and so on and so forth. And they've now been backed by, I think it's 89 countries. And China turned around and put an 80% tariff on barley, on Australian barley. And so, you know, these sorts of things, those are all, again, it's not necessarily always about the actual supply. You talk about the oil crisis. It wasn't about supply. It was about the access to supply. It was about the movement of those goods from one place to another, which we've experienced that since Bretton Woods. Everybody's taken it for granted that moving shit around the world is just easy. Oh, you just, like, you want to buy something? Go to Amazon, buy it. And where do you live? Oh, you live there. It doesn't matter. They'll get it delivered. UPS will deliver it. It wasn't a problem. And so we've become very, very complacent around supply chains. We've become extraordinarily complacent around our energy security. And none of that is priced. None of that is priced.
Yeah, I noticed in going back to that chart where I was looking at oil, the two bull markets, 1970s, and then the one that started around 98 or 2000, right around there, both of them were kind of triggered at the beginning by some sort of geopolitical event. And that really kind of kicked things off, or that was the spark, or that added fuel to the fire. One thing I was thinking about the other day on the topic of oil, and I'd like to get your feedback on this to see if you think this might be an additional demand component, not now, but maybe longer term in the future, or just tell me if I'm crazy. I definitely could fall into that bucket as well. But if I'm, is China is a net importer of oil, is that correct?
Yes.
Okay, so if I'm China and I know that my goal is to have this rural economy go into the urban area and then to expand into Africa and South America and all these different places, that requires energy. And as of right now, the most dense form of energy is oil. That has the densest energy component to it. Is it nuclear? Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So, but oil has a very high density there as far as the energy component. Yeah. So especially when you look at its price compared to how much energy you get per barrel of oil. So if I'm China and I'm like, okay, I need a dollar denominated asset because I've got a peg, I need dollars, it's the world reserve currency, and we're supplying all these goods to the United States. Your point, that may go down in the future, but right now, we're getting a lot of these green dollars and we're sending the United States a lot of our manufacturing. So currently we're buying treasuries, a lot of those, but let's just say that the yields on treasuries go negative. Let's say they go down to like a -1 or -2, something like that. If I'm China, now I've got a negative carry on my dollar denominated assets. So then maybe you want to go to cash, but could another alternative potentially be going to oil? Because oil is definitely something you're going to need long term. You can get it now at half of the cost of production. And it's a dollar denominated asset. And I know it's got storage costs and whatnot, but if you're a huge country, I'm sure that you could somehow build some sort of way to store it that would most likely be cheaper than the negative carry you would have on a treasury at -1 or 2%. What do you think about that?
Makes a lot of sense, George. I mean, I do know that, like, there's been a lot of talk around the Chinese dumping treasuries and things of that nature, but the reality is that's unlikely because they need dollars in order to purchase all of these goods that they are reliant on. So, you know, as we know, they're reliant on obtaining energy from external sources. So, and in order to do that, they need dollars. The world, I can't remember the number, I've got it sitting here somewhere. So it's a very, very small amount of trade that's actually done in renminbi. Other countries are not prepared to trade in renminbi. It's that simple.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and Kyle so, asked about that a lot.
Yeah, it's the idea that the Chinese are going to dump treasuries rests on the idea that they would literally shoot themselves in the foot in terms of having their nation supplied with goods and services that they have to have to operate. So I don't see that as a high probability, but your point of essentially securing things that they will need for sure and which would have a relative better return on capital makes a lot of sense. There we don't know for sure the numbers, but I look in 2019 from what we can tell. From the numbers that are being presented, and again, any numbers out of China are to be treated with a certain amount of skepticism. But they were already building their strategic oil reserves and filling them up. I suspect they're full to the brim now. And so I think you know, given the extraordinary setup with oil today, they're probably fully loaded, but they may be looking at to do similar things outside of oil, but other assets that, you know, because the other component behind this, and it's one that I've grappled with, is assets that countries own outside of their own borders can quite quickly come into question as to, do you really own them, right? So, for example, Venezuela just recently tried to get $1 billion worth of their gold from the UK, and they got blocked.
Right.
You could say, well, it's their gold, it's Maduro's gold, but, you know, there's sanctions on the country and all, so they've just said, no, you can't, it's not yours, you can't have it. You know, you're an illegitimate leader, and you're a, and they're right on all those fronts, but it doesn't really matter whether they're right or wrong. The point is that, you know, that sort of world is coming at us really quickly. And so if I were China, for example, and I was looking at all these assets that are owned in other countries, given how they're now reacting, for example, to inquiries about the coronavirus and such, and it's, they're rather belligerent. And so those can quite quickly be become used as weapons, right? I mean, we saw that after 9/11, where if you were Middle Eastern money and you had it in the US, in US banks, you know, that started, there was a massive sucking sound coming, because a lot of those Middle Eastern investors and whoever, and some of them were probably crooks and some of them weren't, who knows, but they all pulled their money out because there was accounts being frozen, right? Which incidentally actually landed up being one of the reasons that Dubai boomed to the extent that it did, because there was all this capital influx, and Dubai is one of the places that's treated as sort of the Switzerland within the Middle East. Anyway, but so there are likely to be capital flows around the world as this geopolitical tension increases. And really what you're looking at is new allies being formed, new relationships being built between countries, between industries, and it's going to be a chaotic, volatile period of time. So, but it's one that we have, and we have to deal with it. And we've got to do our damnedest at doing so. But in that kind of environment, fixed assets, things like real estate become more problematic, right? And you're a US citizen, right? So let's say you'd bought a property in Shanghai, you know, tit for tat, you might just find that it's not yours anymore, and you're not your government, but it doesn't matter. So those are things that I think investors are going to have to start thinking about.
What about, I want to ask you on that. That's a very interesting take. What about if I'm a real estate investor, let's say in Los Angeles and or Vancouver, Canada, even more so, and I know that the market there has been propped up by a lot of Chinese money coming in, and I hear Chris McIntosh say these things, the first thing that comes to my mind is, wait a minute, maybe the United States is going to get very defensive against China, and they're going to restrict Chinese coming in and actually buying assets. They're going to go back to, let's say, the Japanese in the 1980s coming in and buying all the stuff in New York and Pebble Beach and whatnot, and they're going to put a stop to it. Could that dampen demand in some of these areas with Chinese money coming in the real estate market just as easily? I mean, I guess my question is, could the United States do that just as easily as China could from a standpoint of real estate or any other asset that could be owned by an individual that isn't a national?
I think on a geopolitical basis, it's inevitable. I also think on a national basis, it's inevitable that some of these assets are going to be taxed. So,
oh, right,
so
right.
You know, so there's a lot of different factors coming in there. So, for example, if you're in California is a good one because they're broke. right? They're going to go after anybody with money. And that whole, remember we talked about the inequality that's taking place? Think about Silicon Valley, right? Mm, so these right. largely have benefited in this environment relative to other states and call it economies within the states that have been shut down and told that they're non-essential. But the Zooms of the world and the tech plays are still can operate because they live in a virtual world. And so there's a relative discrepancy taking place there. That breeds more inequality. It breeds more social unrest and things of that nature. But then on a political front, it's easy to say, well, we've got to solve this problem. And the socialists will look at it and go, okay, well, who's got money? Again, it's not about expanding the pie. It's about right. saying, here's the pie. How do we divide it? Oh, those guys have got lots. They don't. We can fix that. You know, it's like you've got kids and you chopping up a cheesecake. It's pretty fucking simple. No, it's like, how many are there? And it doesn't matter if Joey over there mowed the lawn and Susie didn't. It's like everyone gets as the same sort of piece. And so, so that's, you know, there's the geopolitical side of things. And then, of course, there's on the domestic side. And you can't really, they're all need to be considered. While that's taking place, of course, when you have things like MMT coming down the pike, which is just monetizing the debt issuance, that's going to be inflationary. So you would say, well, maybe you want to own real estate in that sort of environment. But the serviceability of it is also going to become a problem. And so, you know, a lot of these things need to be considered. And that's where I try and look at the globe and say, you know, on a big trend basis, what are those major trends? Is it sort of socialism? Is it Marxism? Is it some sort of authoritarian? Like, you know, who's doing what and what are the major trends, and keep a really beady eye to see how it's a little bit like I was saying this to a mate yesterday. When the chips are down, that's when you find out who your friends are, right? George, I need your help. Like, you know, my business is fucked or whatever, you know, do you help me? Do I help you? And so in those environments, that's when you sort of start seeing where, you know, what a society is going to do or what a person's going to do, but in this instance, what a society is going to do. And so I'm watching super, super close because we're in this crisis, which is an economic crisis. It's impacting citizens around the world. And it's the first time I can think of where this has been a global type of thing. It's, you know, there's always been some problem going on in some particular country. And I've always looked at it like fish in an aquarium, and you go, okay, well, what are they doing and why are they doing it? And how's that likely to play out, right? And in this instance, it's happening everywhere. So we actually have this unique ability to look at very much the same problem being layered on countries and see who does what and how and how. And that's largely social trends. It's what the populace want. It's what they expect. And then, you know, again, that comes back to my views on what I'm seeing largely in the East, for example, where to a large extent, it's like sorted out. It sucks, but there's not a belief by the citizenry that the government will solve their problem for them. And hence, there's also not a belief from the government side of things that they should solve the problem.
Right. So long term, that's where you want to allocate capital. I think that's the takeaway here. Number one, you're very
which
bullish.
Which I'm not doing oil. Yet.
You got them on your watch list, so
very
to speak.
Much.
So if I'm an investor, number one, what would you suggest as how are you playing oil? Let's start there. And number two, when we talk about a watch list for other countries, what countries are you kind of really have your eye on? And then if you don't like real estate, or maybe you do like real estate in those countries, you know, if I'm an investor, how do I play that? Because even if I own equities, I mean, you could say almost the same thing, or you own bonds, or if you're a foreigner, and they can just pull the trigger no matter what you own. I guess they could do that domestically as well. But how are you reconciling that with your other view?
Yeah, look, I mean, the first thing is to realize that we don't know, okay, and never to be dogmatic around a view be flexible and continuously watch what's going on. In that respect, I'm concentrated but diversified. So we're fairly concentrated towards a stagflationary environment and the various asset classes that would benefit in that. Energy falls into that, oil falls into that. I do think oil's got a longer time frame, and in other words, I don't think oil's going to turn around tomorrow, but I don't care. I'm looking out with a longer time horizon, you know, trying to figure out what's going to happen in the next few weeks or months is a fool's errand. Or maybe there's people who can do it, and good luck to them. I'm more interested in preserving my capital and making sure that I get those major trends right, because you don't have to do a whole lot more if you do. You think about tobacco. If you had bought tobacco in the 70s, in the 90s, when they all figured out that it causes cancer, you didn't have to do anything. You literally just bought those things, compounded the dividends, and it was the best sector to own, bar none. It beat tech, it beat everything. Tobacco. Yeah. Dirty, stinky, disgusting tobacco. Now, that's a big trend. So I'm more concentrated on that. With respect to countries that I'm interested in.
This podcast is sponsored by my friends at Capitalist Exploits, one of the few research letters I read myself. If you want more information on how this powerful tool can help you become a better investor, plus get a 15% discount, check out our affiliate link. We'll put it right in the show notes page.
How are you playing oil? You talk about just you're in it for the long term because you see this as a secular trend, so to speak. So, and I my guess is you're not in futures, and you wouldn't suggest going into like the USO because of the contango. No. And so you just got a negative roll on that. So if anyone hasn't seen my video on why you should not buy the USO or an oil ETF, that the underlying asset isn't oil, but it's actually the futures market, check out my video on that. It has all to do with the forward curve, I believe they call it, being in contango. But so what do you suggest?
Yeah, I mean, ETFs are fine. Some are fine. But they're all made different. So you got to be like, and you pointed that out. So everyone should go and check that out. But essentially, any ETF where it is tracking a futures contract, you're going to get roll decay. Over time, it's a disaster, even if you get the trend right. So right. They're literally designed to decay over time. You could literally just short, especially the leveraged ETF. If you've got a leveraged ETF that is tracking futures contracts, if you've got time, which pretty much everyone has, you could literally just short that thing forever, and you will over time make money. Yes, it'll have spikes, and you might get margin calls and you get whipped out, but over time, it's like a guaranteed freaking money maker. Anyway, so the point is, we don't touch futures. I don't like the leverage. I don't want to have margin calls. Wouldn't touch any ETFs that are tracking futures contracts. But in the energy space, there are some big, big companies like Royal Dutch is one now, Royal Dutch Shell. It's a well-run company. It's not going away. And so that's, over time, I'm comfortable owning something like that.
What would your rebuttal be someone that said, oh, yeah, Chris, but they just cut their dividend and they haven't done that for 50 years, and doesn't that scare you?
Yeah, we knew they were going to cut their dividend. You could see it coming. And so the market already started. Look at the share price. You saw it bloody pricing it in. It was kind of an obvious thing. The question really is this. In 10 years' time, are we still going to be using oil? If the answer to that is yes, undoubtedly, or at least probably, then you say, well, who's going to be on the other side? Who's going to be alive in that time frame? And how do we get there? And so you look at the guys that are going to survive, realizing that they're going to have extraordinary market share because everyone's getting killed right now. And energy is this absolute necessity for civilization. So I don't think people have to get too fancy about it, George. You can literally, I mean, you can go out and buy large caps as if they're trading like small caps at the moment. So just be, if you want to get spicy, you could look at offshore. Offshore went into this getting absolutely hammered, slaughtered. And yet we still globally get about 30% of our supply from offshore, and it's been treated like a red-headed stepchild because Greta told us that we don't need it anymore. And then all the virtue signaling CEOs followed step, as did the sovereign wealth funds. And that's just one of the most unique setups I've seen in all of my career. This extraordinary shift in narrative. Now, if you go through a period of time where we have this increasing antagonism geopolitically, and you're a political leader and you don't have energy security, what are you going to do? Are you really going to be worried about Greta or some virtue signaling CEO about climate change or any of this? I doubt it. I think that change is coming, and it's going to surprise the hell out of people. Look, in all investing is just a matter of probability. I'm not saying go and back up the truck on it. You can take a few percent of your portfolio and put it into something like that. And it makes a lot of sense to me. So on the energy side of things, I mean, and there's many things in the energy complex. Uranium is one of them that we're long. Coal, which we've spoken about before. You don't have to get
by the way, after our conversation and reading a lot of your research on it, and I want to be clear, for anyone who's considering purchasing research, whether it's Chris or anyone else, I would not suggest doing it just to get stock picks. If you're doing it just to get stock picks, I think you're not doing it for the right reasons. You do it to educate yourself and then come to your own conclusions on what's best for you for your portfolio. But I went through that process, and I came to the conclusion back in March after our conversation that I was going to buy a few things. Number one was the shippers, uranium, and coal. I bought actually Shell as well. But uranium has just massively gone up. If people haven't followed that, I mean, it's up tremendously since I bought it after our conversation. So is coal. And the shippers are down a little bit. So maybe you want to talk about those three things really quick?
Look, and we do this often in the publications we put out. You would have seen them. Most of these things haven't moved at all. If you look at a short-term chart on them, fine.
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about. I mean, uranium is up huge. But yeah, to your point, not. If you look at the long-term chart,
pull it out over a 10, 20, 30-year time frame and actually take a look, see that you can't even see the move on the chart. You cannot see it. It's not there. It just disappears, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And so that context is everything. And the thing that we focus very heavily on is getting these big trends, and you sit on them for years. It's not about trying to make money in the next six months, you know, like, fine, you know, a blind monkey can pick a stock that's going to go up 200-300% at some point in time, right? So, you know, I'd be very cautious of just looking at, this stock's going to rocket for whatever reason. And look, there are some fantastic stock pickers out there, but for the most part, that's not what we do. We look at these major trends. You get behind that major trend. Look, tobacco, we talked about. So tobacco, if you bought it at the lows, you had to wait 3 years. It literally bumped and grinded along. Depending on where you bought, you could have been anywhere from up like 100% to down 70%, right? But in buying at those lows, and you waited for 3 years before it really started climbing. And for the next 20 years, you just made money. And then the dividends were huge. You compounded the dividends. And these things, I mean, you literally would have beaten Buffett by sitting there and just buying tobacco stocks. Nothing else. Just buy them, sit on the beach, and just fucking have a good time. So like when you think about energy stocks or think about any of these things, they're very cyclical. I just ran a webinar yesterday, which went on for like 3 hours because we had so many questions from subscribers. But, you know, and people, it's easy to kind of get worried. They're like, oh, you know, the price of this thing has gone up by like 30-40%. Do I take profits? And I'm like, what's changed? Like the price changed. Nothing else has changed. Chill, calm down. Like, you know, and then you get the same question. Oh, price of this thing's gone down 30%. Did you get it wrong? Like, you know, and so it's just, if you do all your, it's like, what's that saying? You know, measure twice, cut once, right? Like do all your work, make sure you know what you're buying, why you're buying it. And in the noise, and we're in the most noisy, chaotic environment I've ever been in. People don't know what to do. So they're jumping this way and they're jumping that way. And the most dangerous thing you can do is let price determine your actions.
Right.
And if you know what you bought and why you bought it, and then you're fine. And you can keep reassessing that because you will get some shit wrong, but you keep reassessing it and you go, okay, is my thesis flawed? Is there something that's changed? Maybe a government's coming with some regulation that just destroys this, or there's things that can happen. You've got to be open to them. Again, like you can't be myopic and just be like, oh, it's only this and I'm right. And like, then you're going to get stuffed. So that's just, I think, a smart way to do it. But you asked the question about countries that I'm interested in. I've looked at the balance of payments on across countries, because your balance of payments gives you an indication of what's kind of like the balance sheet, or it's more the income statement of a country, and then looking at those countries and saying, what's the social construct look like? What are the governments doing? What are the people doing? Are people clamoring for Marxism as they are in the West? You know, because if they are, shit, we're in for trouble. What is taking place? And so there's a few highlights there. I quite like, Thailand, even though it's a military dictatorship that pretends they're not. So there's a lot of political instability there, and that's something to be careful of. Vietnam is interesting as well. Taiwan's a good one. Taiwan's got a problem with China, and you know, I don't know if you saw the news just recently of what's going on with Hong Kong and China. Like the Chinese are very much putting pressure on there and stepping in. And there's no one really, I don't see any Western democratic country going in and stopping them at this point in time. You know, in the chaos of anything, you'll see, it's a little bit like when you had Hurricane Katrina. Was it Katrina? Yeah. And you had people looting and rioting, you know, taking advantage of a situation. We're kind of in that world geopolitically today. And so we're seeing countries taking advantage in various shapes or forms. So it's, I think personally for me, it's kind of a time to be liquid insofar as owning things that I can buy and sell on an exchange with fair ease and ability, being diversified, and trying to figure out where and how that dust settles, because I think there's going to be some significant bargains there. So if we get the dollar rally that I'm anticipating, then a lot of these emerging market countries, which if they don't go down the increased debt, you know, pay for all sorts of social, you know, programs and so on and so forth. In other words, if they basically let the chips fall, take the pain, then I think there's going to be some fantastic opportunities there, really fantastic ones. And so I'm keeping my eye on that. In stocks and in real estate as well. You know, like one of the things for me, also is physically, like I've lived in 7 different countries, I've traveled to a lot, and you know, you want to be somewhere that's relatively safe,
yeah,
where, and that's increasingly of concern to me, and so, and my kids, you know, the world that they're going to enter is very important for me. I want to make sure that that we're in the right sort of spot and have options. You know, go back to, you know, beginning of the century, anyone should have just moved to America. That was the move. That's what you needed to do. You know, your options and your kids' options and your grandkids' options were going to be so much better than pretty much anyone else on the planet just by doing that one thing. And I feel like we're moving into a similar stage in history. And so I want to try and make those, as best as I can, make adequate decisions there. But that's a longer term view, and it's not even so much about just trying to make money in the short term. It's kind of more important stuff. You know, do you suddenly land up living in some Marxist hellhole? It can happen.
So when you're talking about real estate, you're talking about not only maybe investing in real estate or rental properties or through a REIT or something, but you're also talking about figuring out where you want to physically be with your family.
Yeah. The same. And ultimately, if you get that right, it's probably a similar trade. One is to where you would physically look, if you would physically be someplace that's good for you, good for your capital, safe, economically strong, that's a perfect environment to invest in real estate anyway.
Yeah, right.
So, yeah.
So are you looking at those same countries for the real estate and the personal component of it when you're talking about Thailand, Vietnam, Taiwan?
Potentially. Yeah, I mean, so yeah, there's the physical side of things. I've lived in Thailand before, but yeah, right now is not the time.
Yeah, right
now is definitely not the time. The real estate market for, if we just took Thailand, is oversupplied. It's Vietnam is still expensive, so but the underlying social construct of those countries is more favorable to me than many other countries around the world. That's what I'm saying. So I'm going to sit and watch them. There are other places that I'm looking at purely from an investment perspective that are very interesting to me. Dubai is one. And I've been looking at potentially setting up a fund. I was just going to be myself and some mates, and then I opened the question to subscribers, just saying, hey, this is what I'm thinking, and let me know, and if there's enough interest, then we'll just put a vehicle together to go and do it. But basically the thesis is this: Dubai is the money center for the Middle East. It's the playground of the Middle East. It's got relative rule of law. It has favorable tax structure. And it has freehold real estate that anybody can buy. Very, very unique. Actually, anywhere in the world, quite frankly. And it is extremely tied to oil. Right now, it's absolutely being just decimated. It's the place.
Is the state market mess. Specifically there?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, they have massive oversupply. They had something called Expo 2020, where they basically built a shit ton of apartments and everything else, expecting a massive influx, and it didn't happen. I mean, now it's not going
to
happen.
Is their currency pegged to the dollar?
Yep. Pegged to the dollar. Yeah. AED's pegged to the dollar. And the other thing is that the country's mostly expats. There's only about 40, 50,000 actual citizens. And there's millions of apartments and buildings and everything else. It's all expats. And all the expats are leaving or have left. So it's a real destruction, and it's
so why have they left? Because of the virus?
No, because it's the oil industry. I mean, everything is synthetically off the back of the oil industry, kind of, really. And that's just being slaughtered. And so you can get prime real estate, like real, you know, like the Burj Khalifa, which everyone knows if you basically, you know, look at any postcards in Dubai, it's this building, and it's, you know,
Mission Impossible. Or I'm sorry, not Mission Impossible. Yeah, that's the
one of those. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm thinking about the tallest building there. You're talking about the hotel that's shaped like a sail, right?
No. So that's the Burj Dubai. The Burj Khalifa is that tall one.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, got it.
Which is actually apartments. So you can buy that. You can't buy that. I don't think you can buy into the hotel. It's just a hotel. That's the sail one. But and that thing's considered to be like a 7-star service for the apartments. Yeah,
it's staggering. Staggering.
It's ridiculous. Which also means that the service costs on all these things are fairly high. But the point is, like in a boom, that's where people all went. It was like, oh, you have an apartment in the Khalifa. Oh, wow. You know? And it was, I still remember a conversation back in the previous boom between I was listening to it actually at the airport, and these two Arabs basically just grandstanding, and the one was like, oh, I have an apartment, yeah, and it costs me like $100,000 a year in service costs or something, and the other guy was like, mine cost me 120, you know, sort of thing. And it was like this, you know, mine's more it was like if you were spent more, then you were a bigger dick. And look, that's just what happens in this boom. And it was like the more you could spend, the more ostentatious you could be, the more you had status, right? We humans are a bunch of morons. But anyway, so we're going to go back to that at some point.
Are you worried about the peg? Because I'm assuming they're keeping that peg.
Yeah. No, I'm looking forward
dollars, to it. So.
Well, that's what I'm watching very closely, all these dollar pegs. If we get the dollar pegs breaking, it's gonna be wonderful, and you'll pick up.
Take real estate down even further. I'd need to think that through. How would that work?
Yeah, because it's gonna revalue to a lower level. It'll be priced in dirham, presumably.
So their currency dropped. So it's artificially high right now, not artificially low.
Yeah, because look, I mean, all their revenues are in oil, really, and oil's not doing so well. And so you can actually sit and look at all the FX reserves, and there's like Oman, Qatar, all those countries. Some are a little bit worse than others. Oman's in a pretty shaky space. Trying to trade those currencies is really difficult, though, because there's no real market. You have to, in order to get a market made, you have to go to a large bank and get a market made to structure a product to short a lot of those pigs.
So you're thinking that potentially they've got an artificially high currency because of the peg. The peg breaks because they don't have the FX reserves. If it breaks, then the currency, their currency, goes down relative to the dollar, which would push real estate prices up denominated in their currency. Is that how you're seeing it?
Yeah, but they'll still come down on a real basis. So on a nominal basis, in terms of dirham, but like none of the stuff's priced in dirham anyway. It's all priced in dollars. But if it was, it still would be. It would
in
still
dollar
go down.
It goes down. Dirham terms, it goes up.
Yeah, but the dirham would be collapsing more than that. So, let's say the dirham collapsed by, just say for shits and giggles, 80%. Then the price might go up by 40%. In dirham. So you're still
so in dollars, you're still losing. So you're waiting, are you trying to wait for the opportunity for that to happen and then go in and buy real estate with dollars to get that 40% break on what's already super cheap because of the decimation of the oil industry, or what's your angle?
Pretty much.
Yeah.
And look, it's you know, the best situation you can be in as an investor is one where you don't have to do anything. And if it doesn't happen, it doesn't happen. But if you get a setup where it's kind of a no-brainer, then you act on it. You know, so again, you don't want to be in this sort of position where you go, oh yeah, this is a great idea, I'm just going to go and do it, and you start talking yourself into why it's such a wonderful idea. Just wait, just be patient, let the market tell you what you got to do. And so it's already a blood in the street scenario. It is really, really hurting.
How much of the real estate prices come down there in price per square meter?
Well, I wrote a whole article about this before the coronavirus. And to give you some, so the Khalifa, which is the most expensive I could find real estate, was cheaper than apartments in Ho Chi Minh City. And in Ho Chi Minh City, you still walk out the door and there's still sewage on the fucking footpath and big beggars and... Like, you know,
there's no sewage on the footpath in Dubai. That is for sure.
Yeah. It was cheaper than Sydney, which is easy. Cheaper than Cape Town. It was cheaper than Nigeria. I'm trying to get.
So in dollars, I'm guessing if that's the case, in dollars, was it around, I'd say, what, 1,500, 2,000 a square meter?
Hang on a second, because you guys, I had prices in square feet, and I always have to try.
Okay, well then that would be around $150 to $200 a square foot, just to make it easy.
I'd have to get back to you on the exact numbers, George. I don't want to give the wrong numbers. That was last year I was looking at it. And I've been trying to get numbers from agents, and I've got some friends over there that are trying to get me adequate numbers, and it's really chaotic and no one really wants to give you proper numbers.
Yeah.
There is a database you can pay and tap in and find where the transactions are actually taking place. But indications, at this point, everyone's hanging on. Those people who can are hanging on because they're kind of on paper, they've lost so much. So I'm waiting for that final capitulation, where they just like, this is just not coming back. It just, it's just not happening. And so I'm seeing, for example, with a lot of the apartments that were built for this Expo 2020, where now they're like offering free leases for 5 years. And all sorts of just nonsense. Because the thing is, if you've got no one in them, right, then it's like no one wants, you don't want to walk into a place that's just a ghost town and I'll buy that. And you've got no neighbors and you've got no ambience, you've got nothing. You're like, what the hell? So they're trying to just fill them with people, which might get some interest. But it's not working because the underlying economy is under such severe pressure. And the other component behind it is that in the UAE, if you have debt and you don't pay it back, there's debtors' jails. It's like there's not a bankruptcy process there, right? so if you're some expat and you borrowed a bunch of money and you bought a nice apartment and then the world turned to shit, what do? You get out.
Like, you leave the country.
You don't have
I know they don't have interest, but I didn't realize they had like debtors' prison.
And so you literally leave the keys in the letterbox and you get the hell out. So it's we were talking before about places you want to live, like I don't want to live there. And they've locked the place down, right? And I think there's a big portion of it is like they don't want people leaving that owe money because it exacerbates the problem. But at the same time, if you've got no cash flows, what are you going to do? So it's just a really bad situation for anyone stuck there who doesn't have cash flow and can't pay for their debts. And it's, I don't know how it's going to be resolved, but it is a true...
Sounds like a fantastic opportunity for investor though. I mean, that was one thing I wanted to discuss with you just on a personal level, more of a selfish question, because I'm in Colombia and Medellin, as you know, and I've invested heavily in real estate here and done well since 2015. And now I'm starting to see a lot of supply come onto the market that wasn't there before. So I'm looking, maybe I can get some good deals here. But then I'm asking myself, boy, do I really want more of my portfolio denominated in pesos? And I've got a good mix right now between different currencies, so I'm not overweight dollars or overweight pesos. But if I bring another, you know, call it 500 grand US down here, well, now I've got quite a bit of peso denominated assets. And do I really want to do that? But now that you talk about Dubai, I'm like, wait a minute, that would be good, because you've got something that could have a dollar peg, maybe not now, maybe it breaks, but it's just kind of put that on the radar.
Well, think about it like this.
Very interesting.
If you get your top tier assets, there's still going to be occupancy. It's just going to be cheap, right?
Yeah.
Like a lot of the shitty stuff that's been built out, like it's going to be empty for some time. And maybe they even bulldoze it. Maybe the government comes in with an idea to bulldoze it. Who knows? But your top tier stuff, there's always going to be demand there.
Yeah, they're not going to bulldoze the Khalifa, that's for sure.
No, exactly. And so stuff like that, you can buy it on a positive carry.
You can buy
it on a positive carry. It's like probably the most well-known building in the world, right?
Oh, for sure. What are the property taxes like there, Chris?
There's no taxes.
No property.
There's a transaction tax. No taxes. There's a transaction tax of 4% buying and selling, and then they tax goods. So like you go there and you buy a beer and it's $20. That's how they make it. That's their tax.
So it's a big VAT for sales tax.
Yeah. But it's been set up like a tax haven, right? So. You know, you don't pay a tax. It's good for rich people, where you'll go and you'll spend maybe $500 on dinner or whatever, and you don't care about that, because you're saving millions in terms of your whole tax structure, right? But anyway, so from the property side of things, there's it's very favorable. And again, it's freehold real estate, so you can own it outright. And you've got this positive carry, and synthetically, you basically are long the energy markets because it's the financial hub of the Middle East. Like when anything gets done, that's where it gets done. That's where it gets done. And then when times are good, that's the playground. I mean, it's the weirdest place. Like you wander down the street and there's a girl in a full burqa, and then there's a girl in a bikini.
Yeah, you know, right. Like on the beach. Exactly.
Yeah, and it's just, and that's what, like, the Arabs love it, because it's this big, you know, it's like you can kind of be free and you can kind of do what you want to do.
Yeah, you can get a beer, whatever. You can get alcohol in the hotels and stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, again, it's not a place that I want to, like, live or anything, but from an investment speculative sort of positioning, I looked at that and I'm like, that's really quite unique. And so, so I was going to just get a bunch of buddies. There's a buddy of mine who actually brought it to my attention some time back, and we started looking at it. And then we're like, oh yeah, we'll go and probably, you know, maybe we'll just look at going in halves and buying an apartment and do that. And then, long story short, eventually I said, okay, well, maybe to do it at a better scale, just put together a corporate entity. And then instead of me just buying one apartment with my buddy, like we could buy a whole floor, you know, because I started talking to agents anyway. And you could, obviously, you buy a floor, you get way better pricing than if you bought one. And so I put an analyst of mine onto it. And anyway, we've been watching it, and I'm glad we didn't. You know, we were just investigating and watching, and then this thing came along, and this has just been like, you know, the virus together with the oil wars have just been
Merry Christmas.
They've been Merry Christmas on it, and because I knew the supply side, so I was waiting and being patient, because the whole supply of properties that were built for Expo 2020 were coming on, And so I wanted that to really hit that market, to really just swamp the fuck out of it. And that's been happening. But we've had all of this other stuff. And so part of me just sits there and it goes, okay, what else could you throw at these guys? Like, what out? Like, and the only thing I can think of is the war with Iran. That would be like, you know, worse. But, you know, barring that, I can't really think of anything worse to throw at them. And so, you know, I don't think it's anything you've got to jump into like right now. I'm not. But probably 6 months, in the next 6 months, 12 months maybe, somewhere there. I'm going to start looking to.
Fantastic idea. As soon as this virus is in the rearview mirror, I'm definitely going to go out there. I've been to Dubai before. I absolutely love it. I'm looking to put more money to work in real estate. I want some diversity. That's going to be, I cannot wait to get out there.
Going into this, George, I could get 3.5 cap on Khalifa.
Just using no leverage?
Yeah.
Okay, just a straight 3.5 cap. Yeah, so that's not great.
It's the Khalifa, though.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
Like, so if you went down the marina and you went elsewhere else, like you're up to 10, 12, 15. That was then.
And how, that was a year ago.
Yeah. Well, under a year ago, but yeah, probably like October.
Yeah. Yeah. So okay. I can't wait to check them. That's what I'm going to do tonight. For those of my viewers who want to find out more, first and foremost, if you're interested in Chris's research, we're an affiliate. I'm very proud to be an affiliate for Chris. You can go to georgegammon.com, go to the recommended resources, click on the Capitalist Exploits Insider, and check out all the info. If it's right for you, it's a fantastic product. But for people who want to find out more, Chris, where do they go? I know you're really active on Twitter.
Yeah, I am sometimes, and then I'm not sometimes, depends. Twitter's, what's it, @capex, @capitalistexp is a Twitter handle. Otherwise, it's just capitalistexploits.com or .at. Both will take you there. That's it.
All right, Chris, I appreciate your time. I cannot wait to do it again.
Always fun, man. Thanks for sharing.
Thank you for listening to the Rebel Capitalist Show. For more content like this, check out the Rebel Capitalist blog at georgegammon.com or go to the George Gammon YouTube channel.